For more than 65 years, the Night War has taught us what it takes to fight a war, and what war takes from those who fight. Welcome to March 1944, Part 2. We began last episode with an introduction to Dee Dee Sparrow and Company, and this time we'd like to continue to do our best to answer the question, who was the real Bucky Barnes? Want to introduce the next segment?
Right, okay, so this is The Real Bucky Barnes, Part 3. Our special guest is none other than my very own great-great-uncle, Mr. Theodore Barnes.
That's right. Earlier this week, I called up Uncle Teddy to talk about the podcast, his wartime experiences, and what it was like growing up with, and I quote, the best, kindest, and most pain-in-the-ass big brother there ever was. Okay. Uncle Ted, welcome to the Audio Companion.
Hey, Uncle Teddy.
You can hear me okay?
Crystal clear. So, what do you think about all of this?
Oh, goodness. You mean Bucky's book, or Steve?
Both.
Well, it's not the book any of us ever thought he would write, that's for damn sure.
You've read it, though.
Oh, sure. Bits and pieces. It's not easy reading for me, honey.
I can imagine. Did he write a lot as a kid?
He was always scribbling. He liked to tell stories, too. Read aloud, I mean. And then, I didn't learn this until I was older, he used to change bits.
Really?
Sure. I remember the first time I finished reading Winnie the Pooh to my boys. I put them to bed and went down the hall and said, Alice, we've got a defective copy, and started going on about, I've forgotten their names now, but I remember a parrot, a sheep, and, no, there were a few others, but I can't remember. But Alice thought I'd lost my mind.
So those were characters he'd made up?
Mm-hmm. My sister was a pushy little thing. Well, I say was. That's very kind of me. But she used to get so riled up if she got tired of something, so Bucky would make stories up.
Last episode, we read one of his poems. Oh, yeah. Do you think he wanted to be a poet?
Goodness, no. Well, I have no idea. He was very lively, and you couldn't help but want to be around him, anywhere he was. But his writing, no, he didn't talk about that. Honestly, and I don't think I realized this until I was, after he was called up, I think, that he was such a very sensitive person. Until then, he always seemed, well, he was my big brother.
What was he like, as a brother?
Bossy.
Aw.
Oh, he was. No, Teddy, you've done your tie wrong. Teddy, go study. Teddy, did you go to confession? My God. But he was, well, our father was a troubled man. He was. And so Bucky, well, it was Bucky who put himself in charge of us, and we were better for it.
So was he more of a father figure?
Oh, no. He was always still my brother. But we always went to him for near everything. Hell, he taught me and Jack just about everything a young man needs to know. And he always found a way to, well, he had a knack for solving problems. Or making them seem not so bad.
He made you stay in school, didn't he?
He certainly did. I wasn't quite the student he was either, so I was mad as hell about that. I thought I just had to go until I was 15, like him.
But you graduated high school.
I did. Grateful now, of course, but back then, oh boy, nearly came to blows over it. I was a little stubborn.
Was?
Oh, hush. It was one of those things, you know, it's not like it was uncommon. Plenty of young men and women never got to finish back then, with the Depression. But my goodness, he was sore about it.
He was a good student, wasn't he?
Good at anything he tried, to be honest. I think the only thing, now this is funny, if you'd asked me, what's the job in the army I'd have said Buck couldn't have done? My God, I'd have said anything where he's got to keep still. But he managed it somehow.
He was energetic?
Oh, my Lord, he wouldn't stop. He fidgeted constantly. We'd be sitting in mass and the entire pew would be shaking because he'd be tapping his heels. Tap, tap, tap. And probably bopping his head along to some song in his head on a whole different beat. Oh, and he had this Zippo. He'd taken it to a mechanic shop and used their tools to etch his own initials on it. And it was just all the time. Flip open, flip shut. And if you had to sleep in the same room as him, God forbid.
It sounds like you're still annoyed.
Oh, I am. But anyhow, I remember, well, it was 43, the last time I saw him.
In Aldbourne.
That's right, for Christmas. And we got to spend a little time together. And he told me a bit about, well, what it was like for him to be a sharpshooter. Though I hadn't seen any combat yet, and so, well, you become sensitive to a thing once you've done it yourself. So I wasn't all that gentle with him, though.
Hindsight's 20/20.
My goodness, you have no idea. Anyhow, it was, I remember, we were walking along this village, and I laughed when he was telling me about the sniper work, and I asked him, haven't the Krauts, the Germans, haven't they figured out yet to just shoot at the tree that's jiggling?
You didn't.
I certainly did. And he laughed at me. I swear it was the first time he'd laughed in that entire day and a half I got with him. And he punched me on the shoulder and said, Teddy, you awful jackass. And, well...
What?
Well, I suppose we must have said our goodbyes. Of course we did. And it might be that I'm just an old guy these days, but those are the last words I remember him saying to me. Teddy, you awful jackass. Such a stickler for finding the right way to say things, too. I'm sure he'd think it was funny, us leaving it like that.
He wrote about you a lot in his journal.
He did. He was a very good brother, indeed. He took good care of us. I always thought of him as... Well, it seems silly now.
Go on.
Well, the truth is, I always thought of him as so much bigger than me. Older, I mean. And hearing about his battles on the radio, when we could, or rumors about what the commandos were getting up to. Lord, they were something. Anyhow, it wasn't until, well, it wasn't until I was in my late 40s, right around when my own son died. That hell. All this time, Bucky had been a kid. There I was, thinking he was this grown man, wise in the ways of the world. When the truth of it was, he was only ever a kid.
Des yeux qui font baisser les miens, un rire qui se perd sur sa bouche, voilà le portrait sans retouche de l'homme auquel j'appartiens. Quand il me prend dans ses bras, il me parle tout bas, je vois la vie en
March 14th. I cannot believe it worked. We are back in London. It has been the longest and oddest 2 weeks of our lives. Herr Chaplin in custody and singing like a canary. The artifact E secreted away somewhere, I expect we will not be told, and all seven of us not hurt. But our French comrades, Owen, Paul, and Mark being hopeless communists, uniformly chose to stay, even though there was room on the plane, and no doubt they will be in terrible danger. I feel sick at the danger they all face. The photograph MF managed to take of Goering's train after the bombs and derailment by SNCF workers, Falsworth had the negatives, it turns out, will be on the front page of the London Times tomorrow, and no doubt the New York Times and every other newspaper. Some of the public affairs people were chomping to talk to us, though at the end of about 15 hours of debriefing, none of us was in the mood at all. Even Steve, who normally tries to do his part with a showgirl's flair, which I will never get tired of teasing him over. This is what happened. Mark did meet with Chaplin's driver and paid him several thousand francs to be late and to go have a drink at a particular cafe, where Dernier was waiting to pickpocket him. Dernier got his keys, and after a few drinks with the special powder cooked up by SOE, the driver's uniform, also. Meanwhile, M.F. was surveilling the mistress at the theater. Chaplin's meetings went short at the Majestic, but thank Christ, not too short, because Steve and Monty and I had a hell of a time getting into the Ritz undetected. Might as well have been a party convention with how many goddamn Nazis there were everywhere. And regardless if Steve looks like their Ubermensch, they'll know quite well by now he's not, considering all the photographers he's had taking his picture. Anyway, we did get to the hotel and got the artifact E, as well as a suitcase of other documents, and Genevieve was exactly where she was supposed to be with the bicycles. We pedaled to Gare du Nord barely before Dernier got there. Apparently the fake telegram worked so well that Chaplin was howling for him to drive faster. As Dernier was describing it, I thought that never has someone said Schnell so contemptuously as the world's proudest Frenchman. The rest of us met Jones and Morta. Paul and J.L. had already pedaled several kilometers out along with many other partisans, and boarded the train with the help of a résistant who calls himself Monsieur La Joconde. G laughed and told me La Joconde is what the French call the Mona Lisa, and too bad we made it to Paris and Steve never even got to go to any museums. One day, maybe. After that, it all went very fast. G stayed hidden while the rest of us cleared the train,
mostly empty on account of the short-notice departure, and then met up with Dernier, who already had Chaplin at gunpoint. We had him switch his uniform with one of the Krauts we kept alive, and then jumped the train as soon as we got the radio signal. Perfectly on time, the SNCF truck picked us up for another few kilometers, where we got to watch the train derail and blow up. Chaplin, I think, nearly cried seeing that. We then had to use the truck another several kilometers to get to our egress, and say goodbye to all our allies. I think a part of me thought, surely at least G will come with us, her already being in so much danger. But I cannot account for why I thought that, other than wishing for it. She who has Paris married through her pulse. "Next time you come to Paris, bring your army," she said, with her smile like she is laughing at a secret joke. She gave me a letter folded to a quarter the size of a postcard. We said goodbye to everyone, and the plane came soon afterward. In 6 hours, we went from blowing a train up to being welcomed at OSSSSR command. This is such a strange way to do war. March 16th. Thank God for Carter. As our job in France is now done, for now, I do plan to return with an army. SOE was apparently planning to forget our existence at all. Carter has ways of getting what she wants, no matter what. And so we heard this morning that our entire team is safe and hiding in new locations. They all made contact with a spy radio operator, as they were supposed to. We were all relieved. It feels like those 2 weeks were as long as 2 months. And even though we could hardly communicate with Georges or MF, being there in Paris was like being in a foxhole. Another sort of foxhole than I am used to, and another sort of fear, but in essence the same. And you do not make it through that kind of battle without, in a way, becoming like brothers and sisters. Not Geneviève, though. I keep hearing in my head, l'année prochaine, l'année prochaine, l'année prochaine. I have another sort of family in mind with her. Her letter was very short, a mix of French and English that I was just able to piece together without having asked Dernier or Monty for help. God forbid. As it is, I'm getting enough grief about not even getting a kiss from her. Some tomcat you are, Tugan said.
L'année prochaine avec mon amage, top of the morning, one walks up Montmartre et Sacré-Cœur. Petit déjeuner dans un café, café Grand Canard, fresh, real bread, pain de skew, beurre et confiture de framboise. Bells in all Paris sound joyeuse, à l'heure française. At Sacré-Cœur one can view all Paris free and all France. Toi, à côté de moi, est ambitieux.
When I read it, it feels like a prayer, or a poem, a psalm maybe. Come back with an army, she said. And seeing as there seem to be more Americans in Britain than British, I think it will be soon. I hope it will be soon. Of course, hope is awfully dangerous. On the worst days, I think it might be easier not having any at all. But that is impossible when I now have, next to me, you, and a kiss, written in her unusual handwriting, left-handed, the same hand that has two wristwatches on it. L'année prochaine. L'année prochaine.
March 19th. Several days R&R. A lot of mail waiting for us when we got back. I now get Steve's mail addressed to me from Ma and Curly, on account of, I guess, the army is getting so much addressed to him that they are not sending any of it through. Dugan was dead disappointed when he heard that, as last time Steve got a bag of mail there were about 100 girls' photos in there along with their return addresses, and Dugan got a real kick of helping Cap answer letters. Of course, Steve is as mad as hell they're keeping the mail, not on account of the dames, as I've never seen somebody with eyes only for his girl like Steve since Harry, but because so many little kids send him letters. Dear Captain America, please keep my brother safe. Dear Captain America, please hurry and kill Hitler soon. Steve tries writing them all back, because of course he does. In any case, I said, Steve, better to spend your time doing what they're asking for rather than writing them about it. And he said, I can't do both. For my part, several letters from Ma, Curly, and even two from Ted, who is not in Aldborn anymore, but did not say where he is. Nothing from Jack directly, but Ma says he's written her and is doing fine. Also a letter from Margaret Miller. The twins are healthy and have three teeth between them, which I suppose is good. Frank Castellano's still tracking down everyone from Abel, and I guess word is getting around because everyone is writing him. He got a letter from Joe Fortunato, who is home in Philadelphia, and soon getting married through his girl. He'll have a hell of a limp, but I guess not any problems walking down the aisle. PFC Carl Yates is also back to the 107th and recovered, and so is Walters, who got hurt back in July. Also, Lieutenant Fisher is back in command to Able, or whatever's left of it. According to Frank, they have combined us with Charlie and Fox. How strange to be Fisher and have missed Vanafro by just 3 days, because he took a bullet to the leg at Rocca Varigatti. Luckiest bullet of this entire war, I would say. From home, Curly's still top of her class, and volunteering at a hospital on weekends, because she has decided again to be a nurse. Mrs. Rogers would be proud. Curly also says she sent a postcard of the Empire State Building to my Valentine, Miss Susie Clemens, and says she has written to Bobby Miller again, but still not gotten any responses. Poor Bobby. I can imagine how unfair it would feel to lose a brother like Harry. In fact, I don't need to imagine. I know it perfectly myself. One more day, R&R, and then we are doing signals training for several days. Dugan growling about it already. March 22nd. Wildest day and a half we ever had in London. On Monday, as our last free day, we all decided to go out to a pub. Well, more troops here in London clearly means more idiots. We tried to go to one of our usual spots when an entire platoon of hillbillies stood at the door and picked a fight about not allowing Gabe inside. Now, what got us into trouble was two things. First is that we got asked by the BBC to do a series of interviews on the 20th, and the American brass stopped Dernier and Gabe from joining in on account of Gabe's colored, and Dernier has been practically writing poems about the Gaul who everyone knows Ike hates. So, naturally, Steve then goes on about Gabe and Dernier not being allowed to participate very angrily during the interview, which was being recorded instead of broadcast live, and so OSS forced the BBC to censor it. So Steve was howling mad all day and all the next day about that. And then we run into this pack of clowns who assumed Gabe was trying to get into the pub on his own and didn't realize we were all with them. Or, more to the point, that Steve is goddamn Captain America. So the GIs start tossing around what Monty later called impolite language after we got arrested. And Gabe grabs Steve's arm and is telling him, "Cap, let's go, let's get out of here." And if anything, that makes Steve even more enraged. And frankly, the rest of us are riled up for our part, too. And Steve turns to the ringleader, a Sergeant Monroe, first name Angus, I found out later. Maybe I can sneak off and challenge him to a bit of bare knuckle. And says, "Son, you ain't half the man Gabe Jones is," and punches him across the mouth. So there's about 30 of them and 7 of us, and that's bad odds on their part, for damn sure. We caused the real ruckus. Enough that London coppers and then MPs showed up and started shouting that everybody was getting arrested and courts-martialed. And credit to him, Steve just identified himself as Steve Rogers. And it wasn't until the barkeeper, who had been 2 seconds from calling for Steve's head, suddenly shouted out, "My God, you're Captain America!" Well, then the whole place goes up in uproar, because while not 10 minutes before we were ruffians causing trouble for having a Negro in our party, now it's different, because that Negro is Corporal Gabe Jones, and these are the Howling Commandos. Well, Steve leans into the lead MP, who is also a captain, and says, "Sir, you ought to arrest us. No favoritism." So the entire lot of us get arrested and march down to the MPHQ, and it takes all of an hour for word to get to OSS SSR, and we are all released without charges. But no charges also for the fucking GIs who started the whole thing by going after Gabe, either. Needless to say, SSR was beside themselves. But Steve is, well, there's no other word for it, satisfied as hell that he got to throw some punches, even if he couldn't get Gabe on the radio like we all wanted, and Gabe deserves, in the first place. March 24th. This signals training is not precisely what we hoped it would be. I thought it was to be encryption and coding and decrypting and solving puzzles, but instead it is how to work old radios and radio protocols and so on. Seeing as how we already have Morda and Jones who know everything there is to know about that, I cannot figure how this is worth our while. The only good thing to come in the past 2 days is that our instructor, Mr. Carroll, has got a stutter, and Dugan was sitting there plainly confused as hell and bored nearly to tears if he wasn't chewing a cigar that wasn't even lit and somehow snoring at the same time. And Carroll stomped over, or tried to, as he's a little fellow, and goes,
Sergeant Dugan, are you just a dummy? And Dugan went, in the worst god-awful British accent I ever heard, Why, yes, sir, I think I am. And so we have been calling him dummy for the last 2 days, and it has not stopped being funny yet, and I don't expect it to. Why, yes, sir, I think I am.
March 27th. Urgently assigned a new airborne mission in Czechoslovakia. It is one of the bases Steve identified at Ozano, and apparently some of the intel from Mr. Chaplin has reprioritized it. No time to even train for the jump in mission. We are going out tomorrow night. Only a few hours to get gear together and write new letters for my family if we don't come back. This is a macabre superstition, according to Monty, but I wrote a letter before Sicily, before Salerno, and before Roccavaragatti, but not before Venafro, and look where that got us. March 31st. There is no doubt that our particular enemy, the Hydra Krauts, are a serious one, with serious firepower, and God knows what else up their sleeve. However, it is supremely satisfying, Gabe, to find they run and scream and blow up just the same as regular Krauts when the 8th Air Force puts them on their dance card. What a hell of a sight. We missed our drop zone by several miles because of poor weather, but we're expecting to hump it regardless. Dernier, Monty, and Jim weak as kittens, as they are terribly sick with flu, and naturally did not tell anyone, but Steve and me were able to pick up the slack by sharing their gear between us. Fortunately, this was not what Dum Dum's taken to call in a boom-boom operation on our part. Our job was simply to infiltrate, secure intelligence, wreck their 88s, and ensure any special equipment was destroyed before we called in the bomb raid. And it all went as smoothly as could be expected, as it was clear they were not at all prepared for a surprise attack, and we kicked it off at about 04:30 and had no real problems initially. There were not even men manning the artillery half the time. Only thing that went wrong at all is me catching a bullet in the arm. My left arm, at least, so my trigger finger not affected, though now it hurts like an SOB. Caught a little shrapnel, too, in my side. With my blood up in the fight, I did not even realize what happened until we had finished our part and got the hell out of there, and Steve caught up to me and went so pale I nearly thought he was 12 again with a case of pneumonia that nearly killed him. Since this cap business, he has really turned into a Nanny Barnes himself. In any case, we set the beacons and evacuated the base with the materials and then got to watch the 8th Air Force raise it to the ground from a safe distance. Because Hydra has been siphoning fuel from other Kraut installations and storing it here, the place really went up, and the bombers kept coming. There must have been at least 150 of them, and they flew low and in formation. Monty thought they were not even 20,000 feet up, and supposed they were showing off for Cap, knowing we had destroyed the air defenses. I can still feel the explosions in my chest, it was so loud. As difficult as Austria was, and Greece, and France, it is a relief to get the chance to have a bit of help, and to see what a bit of American muscle in the sky can really do. There was not even a single Kraut plane anywhere to be seen. So much for the mighty Luftwaffe. In the open yesterday and today, as we have a long way to go for our secondary extraction, as the airfield near the base is now blown up to nothing, hoping in 72 hours to be back in jolly old England, the others are really very sick.
Frank's not in. Can I help you? Can I help you? Okay. Okay.
Hey, Frank's young Frank. Oh my god! Hey! Bucky?